Welcome to City Visions. I'm Raja Shah, sitting in for Joseph Pache. Tonight, we're talking about crime and punishment. The United States has one of the highest incarceration rates in the entire world. And here in California, we've had overcrowded prisons for years. The voters here, we went to the polls last November, about a year ago, and took this issue head on by passing Prop 47. It reclassifies certain nonviolent felonies as misdemeanors. The goal was to reduce the prison population and use the savings on social programs. And sure enough, a new study has found that 13,000 fewer people have been put behind bars in California since the law went into effect last year. And the state is expected to save $150 million in this year alone. And there was a lot of a debate about this issue even before the election. And now, a year later, critics say that Prop 47 is the wrong approach, that it's reducing sentencing options for prosecutors and judges, and that it's led to a spike in property crime. So tonight on City Visions, we're going to ask, is Prop 47 working? How do we bring prison overcrowding under control? And how do we balance fair sentencing with public safety? We want you to be an active part of the conversation. So in about 20 minutes, we're going to open up the phone lines. You can call us. The phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment on our website. That's also kalw.org. You can tweet us at cityvisionsklw. In the meantime, let me introduce our guests. First, we have Jeff Adachi, public defender of the City and County of San Francisco. Welcome, Jeff.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We also have Al Serrato, assistant district attorney for the County of San Mateo. Hi, Al.
Hello.
And also we have Milena Blake, a fellow with the Justice Advocacy Project at Stanford Law School. She's also the co-author of the Prop 47 Progress Report. And I should say the Justice Advocacy Project was also involved in drafting Prop 47. Welcome, Milena.
Good evening.
All right. I'd like to begin with, Jeff, if you could explain, what is Prop 47?
Well, what Prop 47 did was it took certain categories of crimes that were treated as felonies and made them misdemeanors. And although it only affected, I think, six categories of crime, it was a sea change because California, had been really strictest when it's come to drug offenses. Many states had already made drug possession a misdemeanor crime. And the difference between a misdemeanor and felony is a felony, you can go to state prison, whereas a misdemeanor, you're looking at county jail time. And what Prop 47 effectively did is it said, well, instead of treating these crimes as felonies, they're still going to be crimes, but they're going to be misdemeanors. And also certain crimes like petty theft up to a certain amount were made misdemeanor crimes. And it was also retroactive, meaning that it applied to people who had been convicted of these crimes and had felonies on their record. So these cases could now be brought back to court. And as public defenders and defense attorneys, it placed the burden on us to reach out to the community to let people know that they now qualify to have their felony conviction treated as a misdemeanor. And it was huge because when you've been convicted of a felony, it means that sometimes you can't get a job, you won't qualify for public housing or benefits or even educational loans. So Prop 47, I think, was a very big change for California. And we're here a year later, and I certainly think that it's been a success. Certainly there have been critics, but overall, we haven't seen a huge change in terms of either crime or the manner in which these cases are treated hasn't had a huge impact. In San Francisco, we helped about 1,200 people so far have their cases reduced to misdemeanors. There are probably about 8,000 people that qualify, so that's a priority for us. But beyond that, it's pretty much been business as usual, except that there are a few people going to prison. There are fewer people who are being convicted of felonies for minor offenses. But I think the real plus is that there are more resources now to be spent on the more serious crimes, on murder, sexual assault, crimes like that. And I think that's what Californians want.
And, you mentioned minor offenses. This is a big part of what Prop 47 does, as you say, is reclassifying certain crimes that were previously felonies as misdemeanors. Can you give some examples? What kinds of things are being reclassified?
Well, for example, petty theft with a prior, which formerly was a felony, is now treated as a misdemeanor if it's under $950. Possession of drugs, for example, possession of cocaine in California was treated as a felony. And there are 13 other states, I think, that it's treated as a misdemeanor, including in the federal system. So, you know, those are probably the biggest categories of you know, the difference in charging that we've seen. Because now, if you're charged with one of these offenses in court, you're going to be charged as a misdemeanor and, you know, not as a felony. Before, you'd face on all of these crimes between 16 months and 3 years in prison. And now you face up to a year in the county jail.
Al Serrato, you're the assistant DA in San Mateo. If we'll get into the meat of Prop 47 and what its effects have been. If there's anything you'd like to respond to that Jeff just mentioned, you can go ahead. But I also wanted to ask you a specific question. We've been talking about misdemeanors and felonies, and I think we all have a rough sense that felonies are worse than misdemeanors. But in terms of what that actually means, what the difference between, say, state prison and county jail is, if you could expand on that. Most of us, knock on wood, have not seen the inside of a jail or a prison.
Well, what Jeff didn't mention was in 2011, there was realignment. So a lot of cases that would result in a state prison commitment are no longer going to they're not going to result in a defendant going to the inside of a state prison.
What is realignment?
Well, that was the passage of 1170H of the Penal Code that changed the sentencing structure, the manner in which people are punished essentially for crime. So rather than going to prison on these types of offenses, and they listed a large number of offenses, they're going to be housed in the county jail with the idea that there are more programs available at a local level to be able to help them. But generally, I think Jeff was accurate in that state prison is more serious. Felonies are more serious. They have consequences to them. And misdemeanors are things that that are typically dealt with probation and perhaps some kind of counseling and a period of time in jail, probably a minimal period. Some misdemeanors are a year, and others are 6 months. So the thing I think the thing I was wanting to say was that the problem with Prop 47 from our perspective is it took away a tool that we made use of, and that was the idea that we escalate our responses so that when you have an individual who's repeatedly committing violations, whether it's repeated drug use, possession for sale or sale of drugs, which would not be encompassed by 47, but is sometimes related, or repeated thefts in order to fund that habit, that you need to escalate the response. You need to create an incentive for them to change. And if they don't want to change, that justice requires that they be punished for it because they're hurting other people. And that's the function of government at the very core level, is to reward the good and punish the wrong, the bad. We can't do that in the same way anymore. And as a result of that, we don't see the same response in drug court. You know, people are not as willing to engage in drug treatment, at least in my experience, and our numbers are reflecting that, because they don't have much to lose if they say no, essentially. They're not looking at serious prison time in some cases anyway. We're also seeing more failures to appear because people will be cited and just not come to court. Whereas in the past, for a felony, they would have been taken into custody, required to post bail. And ultimately, the concern I have is that you're signaling to people that we don't really care about crime, at least what we're calling a low-end crime. I talked to the owner of a mom-and-pop shop, and $950 is a lot of money. And if someone were able to repeatedly steal from them up to $950, that could put them out of business, essentially. So there are real people out there that are being impacted.
$950 is the cutoff between what qualifies as a misdemeanor or a felony under the new
for the theft law. Sections, right.
So we've heard it took away a tool, the ability to escalate responses. Drug courts are not as don't have as many tools to force people into treatment. People are not showing up as much, and as you put it, signaling that we don't care about crime as much. Melena Blake or Jeff Adachi, would you like to respond?
I think one thing that Prop 47 really signaled is that the voters really wanted a shift in the way the system worked. This wasn't simply about treating one crime differently than the other. It's about changing the way we approach crime. And, you know, all the consequences that that the ADA mentioned are serious and are things that need to be addressed. Crime should not happen. It does. It's terrible when someone steals from you. But I think the question is how is the greater law enforcement community responding to this? You can't expect to do the same thing that you were doing before and have a different result. So, you know, for example, talking about an increase in failure to appear. Well, potentially that means that maybe you should be citing less people and you should actually be arresting and booking more people for misdemeanors. There's absolutely nothing in the law that prevents you from doing that. But law enforcement should be using tools to assess the risk of a person of not showing up. And if they think that that person isn't going to appear, then they should book them and they will appear when they're in jail, right? I think historically we have not been able to do that because we haven't had room in jails to hold misdemeanors. But that's one of the beauties of Prop 47 is because jail populations are down, we do have more room and more flexibility to do things like that.
I'd like to respond real briefly. That's just not accurate in terms of citing someone. Unless they don't produce satisfactory ID or the officer can make some showing of continued threat, they're going to be cited. That's the law. It's a misdemeanor. We're not going to be booking them in that setting. I think Jeff would corroborate that.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to mention one thing that Al said. I mean, if you are arrested for one of these crimes, and it also includes things like grand theft under 950 or receiving stolen property, you're facing a year in a county jail. I mean, that's substantial punishment. And as Elle said, because of realignment, I mean, folks were not going to prison on these crimes anyway. They were getting local time. And so convicting a person of a felony, you know, versus a misdemeanor, particularly if it's a nonviolent offense, which all of these are, you know, what is the utility of that? Because essentially what all the studies have shown is that when a person is convicted of felony, you're basically disenfranchising them from society. We've had a movement now called Ban the Box, where we are trying to encourage employers to hire people with felonies. And we have policies in place that now do not allow employers to look into the person's criminal history unless they've made it past the interview process. So, I mean, these are the kinds of reforms that we see in the long term are going to benefit public safety because you're getting people back into the workforce. We have a program called Clean Slate in our office where we help clear over 1,200 records a year. These are people who have been convicted of crimes. And I can tell you the success stories, you know, that I hear of people who are reformed and have been able to turn their lives around. And Prop 47 makes it easier for people to get that kind of relief. You know, we've had people who have come into our office. I mean, both Al and I have been around for, God, too long, 30 years. But we've had people who have had priors from like 40 years ago that are now eligible for relief under Proposition 47. And our district attorney, George Gascon, was a big supporter of Prop 47 in part for this reason. So it's part of, I think, a larger reform effort to decrease our reliance on incarceration and also to focus the resources where they should be, not only for law enforcement to be able to work on more serious crimes, but also, I mean, we're spending more money in California on prisons than we are higher education, and that's something that needs to change.
All right. Well,
so perhaps I should just point out, just so it's clear, that I'm not pro-felony. It's not like I want to see everything be a felony. One of the good changes, I think, was to take some of our felony sections for drug possession that didn't allow for misdemeanor treatment and to make those misdemeanors. Or I would have preferred to have them be what we call wobblers, where they could be charged as misdemeanors or felonies. So in my county, when someone, say, was in possession of methamphetamine, that was a case that was the type of crime that was a wobbler. We could charge it as a misdemeanor, and we often did, especially if there was no record, because, again, of that escalating response. So my position is not that I want to see everyone treated as a felon and be labeled that way. There is freight that comes along with that and with the term. And I think there are things we can probably do as a society to lessen and mitigate that. But for some people who are going to persistently commit crime and don't care about the system's response, we need to have tools to escalate our response. And I think at a real broad philosophical level, Prop 47 requires voters to answer the question who they distrust more. You know, do you have more to fear from the prosecution and the courts that are incarcerating people or from the criminal element? And so I think what it reflected to some degree is that there is a distrust that we're not implementing things correctly. And maybe we didn't get the message out as well as we could have, or maybe people were tired of spending money. But at the end of the day, we have to answer that, because people are being heard out there by people who could have been punished, who would have been punished historically, and who are on the street committing those crimes again. And I brought with me a report where, an officer documented something that a defendant said. I'd like to read it. I think it's kind of anecdotal, but it kind of reflects some of the concerns I have. Can I do that?
Yes, in just
sure.
a minute. I actually want to.
Yeah, no problem.
I want to get to a few points that you mentioned before we get to that. So hold on to that.
Yeah, no problem.
For just a moment. The first thing you mentioned the term wobbler earlier, and this is as I take it, that refers to the discretion that prosecutors have to determine whether a particular crime will be charged as a felony
right.
or a misdemeanor.
Right. Every crime is defined in a code, normally the penal code, but also health and safety and other codes, and the sentence range is provided for us. And some cases, some crimes are straight misdemeanors, some are straight felonies, but a large number had been wobblers. They could be either felony or misdemeanor, and that was within our discretion. The courts had a veto power over that. They could reduce a case to a misdemeanor if they felt that we had overcharged it. So the system had some safety valves built into it, and that's what Prop 47 affected largely.
And is that a good thing? You're arguing that Prop 47 reduced the ability, the discretion that prosecutors have. And my question for Milena and Jeff is that a problem?
Well, so I think one thing that is really interesting is that there was a bill that was a sort of a prior version of Prop 47 that was vetoed by the governor in 2013, SB 649. And what it would have done is it would have made the code sections that were straight felony for simple drug possession a wobbler to allow for DA discretion in charging it. And during that bill, that came out that statewide, the code section for possession of methamphetamine was charged as a misdemeanor 15% of the time. So there was discretion, but it wasn't often being used. And there's probably many different reasons for that. But the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of people who got caught with methamphetamine were charged as a felony, which meant they were potentially going to state prison for $65,000 a year and the long-term consequences of having a felony record. There's almost 4,000 additional collateral consequences or additional punishments that come from having a felony record. And to have that 85% of the time is something that I think that the voters didn't respond well to.
I was going to say, too, it creates unequal treatment under the law, because you're going to have some DAs who are going to charge it as felonies and other ones as misdemeanors. I know that San Mateo has a reputation of being really tough. I mean, I remember when I was in private practice for a short time, you know, you'd cross over to San Mateo and your client suddenly looking at, you know, more time or a harsher outcome. And, you know, certainly every district attorney creates their own policies, which results in charging practices. But, you know, do we really want to give district attorneys the discretion to charge possession crimes and petty theft crimes, you know, as felonies as opposed to misdemeanors? And again, I want to emphasize, it's not like you walk out the door. You're still looking at a substantial punishment for being convicted of these crimes.
Alcerato?
Just briefly there, most of our cases resolve by way of plea bargain. And so there's going to be a starting point. If the starting point is 6 months in county jail, most defendants are not going to get that offered to them. They're going to be offered a fraction of that. So what it does, in essence, is it moves the scale down. When someone's looking at much more time, then you can still plea bargain and have a range of punishment that can deter them. But what we're seeing is that this is part of a process that's devaluing punishment across the board. So someone who 5 years ago would have been sentenced severely to something is, at this point, not going to have that happen. And they know it, at least the ones that are hardened and who are through the system. And they're the ones committing crime.
In those cases where somebody accepts a plea for one of these situations, say drug possession in San Mateo, are they pleading, is it still a felony or are they pleading down to a misdemeanor?
No, there are no felony drug possession charges.
Sorry, before Prop 47.
So, well, some charges were, like possession of heroin or cocaine, were straight felonies. So there was nothing you could do other than a felony. But the goal of the system in with regard to drugs has always been rehabilitation. And we've always pushed the idea of drug court, always tried to get them to modify into a program. And some of the greatest success stories are people who were looking at a 9 or 10 year prison sentence because they had priors. They had strike priors, meaning they had committed multiple other crimes, crimes of violence perhaps. And they modify into Delancey Street, a tremendous program. And they modified into that because they felt that they had hit the bottom. They didn't want to spend the next 8 or 10 years in prison. And that gave them the incentive. Now, that's not necessarily true of everyone, but there are a lot of success stories based on that paradigm, that if you confront someone with a harsh enough choice, they're going to see that this can't continue.
And I've worked, you know, with people addicted to drugs for years, and what I've learned is that people aren't going to change unless they want to change. And the idea that by, you know, hanging a more severe crime over someone's head, it means that they're more likely to get straight. I mean, that works probably for a very small population of people, but by and large, folks aren't going to change their behavior simply because something's a felony versus a misdemeanor. I also think that, you know, the way that the criminal justice system plea bargains cases by threatening a person with a greater charge that they shouldn't have been convicted of or accused of in the beginning really has a coercive effect, and that people are, in essence, pressured to plead guilty to a crime because they're facing a felony exposure. And a lot of people would plead guilty to these crimes. Now, what I'm seeing, and I don't know if this is true in San Mateo, but in San Francisco, crimes that were charged before, like, for example, where somebody had a very, very tiny amount, you know, we call them crumb cases, where you have a little crumb of crack cocaine, is no longer charged at all. And that, I think, is a positive thing. If we look at societies that have successfully been able to decriminalize drugs, and at the same time, and I think we're moving in that direction. You know, if you look at what's happening in the United States with marijuana, have also been able to move more people into voluntary treatment by decriminalizing drug offenses. So I do think that that's part of the big picture where we're moving towards eventually, and I think that that's a good thing.
All right. Well, I want to let people know that if you're just joining us, you're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7, KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're talking about Proposition 47 with our guests Jeff Adachi, public defender in San Francisco, Al Serrato, the assistant DA in San Mateo, and Milena Blake. She's a fellow with the Justice Advocacy Project at Stanford Law School. And we want to hear from you. Give us a call. Let us know if you have any questions or comments for our guests. Did you vote for Prop 47? Were you against it? Maybe you've changed your mind over the course of the last year. Either way, we want to hear from you. And you can give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. And we actually have a caller. I think this is Ken from San Francisco. Let's go to Ken. Ken, are you there?
Hi, everyone. I'm a second-year law student. I have kind of a get-back-to-basics question I hope can avoid politics that's so common in criminal justice. Has there ever been any good studies that show that increasing fine amounts results in greater compliance with the law?
Well, first of all, Ken, you're way too jaded for a second-year law student. I'll let Al take a crack at that question first.
I don't know of any studies that talk about a connection between fines and crime. We don't use fines all that much in San Mateo County. The punishment usually relates to jail time and then efforts to rehabilitate people.
Yeah, I mean, most people, quite frankly, are too broke to pay fines. But it is a huge issue because if you are convicted of a crime, even a misdemeanor, you got to pay probation fees, you got to pay, you know, other fines and fees that are levied against you. You know, even a crime like a DUI, you know, by the time you're paying all the fines, you're talking about thousands and thousands of dollars. So we do have problems in terms of clients who are otherwise meeting their conditions of probation, otherwise law-abiding, but can't afford to pay these fines.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking of, say, Ferguson, where
right.
It was seen that especially people of color, were hit with a lot of fines for quality of life things, even things as simple as jaywalking, parking, speeding, moving violations, that kind of thing. Is there any evidence that that actually makes people obey the law, or is it just people will do a certain amount anyway?
Well, that's, you know, the debate is, you know, to what extent is a penalty, you know, going to deter somebody from committing crime? I mean, if you're, you know, using drugs as your first thought, well, geez, you know, I might go to jail for a felony, so I better not use this. And for people particularly who are addicted to drugs, you know, they're going to use drugs regardless of whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony. It's a question of we as society, are we going to treat a drug user, somebody who possesses a small quantity of drugs, as somebody who needs to go to state prison along with people convicted of murder and rape and other crimes like that?
A drug addict's not going to care whether or not it's a misdemeanor or a felony, but what he's going to care about or she's going to care about is how much time am I going to do? That's the first thing they ask their defense attorney, typically.
Well, not drug addicts, but, you know, people who are not on drugs.
Well, to get back to your question, you can't be incarcerated for failing to pay a fine, and that's probably why we don't do that much with fines. What Jeff pointed out, for instance, with DUI, those are the statutory minimums, I think, typically. You don't normally see a court depart from that and say, we're going to double that fine and we're going to keep you off the road that way in a DUI setting. And if someone is unable to pay, which is often the case, then they're not going to be subject to a probation violation. They're not going to be subject to incarceration for that. It's just not the model that we're using at the in the level of felony misdemeanor. I think where I think of fines is with infractions, which typically are handled in traffic court, usually not staffed by a DA. And they do have an impact, because if you don't pay your fines in a traffic setting, you're not going to get your license renewed or your car re-registered, and that's going to have an impact. So I think there is a connection there. I don't know that there are studies beyond that.
All right. I think that diversion programs have been very successful. In San Francisco, we have diversion programs for misdemeanors, meaning that rather than being prosecuted, you know, by the DA, instead you agree to treatment or some kind of community service, and then the charge is dismissed, and there's no record. That's what diversion is.
Ken, I want to thank you for your call, and we're going to go to Natasha in Oakland next. Natasha, are you there?
Hi, how are you?
All right. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you for having such an exciting show. This is exactly what we've been talking about. In regards to my very good friend's dad, who is serving many, many years under, like, I guess, the RICO Act. So it would have been something from, like, the 60s. You know, everything would I looked at the general guidelines, and I think he would, you know, qualify. Are you guys taking a look at people that are that have been spent a lot of time in jail, and, you know, have you done any of that yet?
Well, it depends on, you know, the crime that he was convicted of. If it was like a RICO conspiracy in federal court, and a RICO was like, you know, what they call a criminal conspiracy,
yes.
Then it's not going to fall under Prop 47. Prop 47 only affects state law. But certainly we're seeing reforms on the federal level. You probably read about President Obama's
yes.
Act of pardoning folks in the federal system, and we're starting to see more of this type of activism. So I would certainly encourage the person that you know, to talk to a lawyer to see. And in San Francisco, we've had about 18 people who have been either brought back from prison or freed from county jail and freed. So it's been a relatively small number of folks. In some counties, you know, prior to the change in the three strikes law, where you can go to, you know, prison for life on a nonviolent felony,
yes.
You know, there were quite a few people who were granted relief from even life sentences. And obviously anyone who was convicted of one of the Prop 47 felonies should be brought back. And some counties, like in, I know, San Bernardino and Los Angeles, you had thousands of people who qualified for relief under Prop 47. But in San Francisco, we've had a tradition of not sending people to prison county jail for these crimes anyway. And so in most cases, you know, they were out of custody.
Yes. Well, I appreciate the work that you do is very important. Now, can I just ask, with COINTELPRO, you know, didn't Obama, like, I don't know, something like he was maybe going to investigate the CIA at some time? You know, I heard briefly that and then nothing else. And was there some kind of monetary payment made to Martin Luther King's family for a wrongful death? Is that, do you know anything about that?
No, I mean, I know about the counterintelligence program, you know, that was waged in the 60s and 70s. I hadn't heard that specifically, no.
Natasha, I want to thank you for your call.
Okay,
we're going
to
go to our...
Okay, appreciate you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. We're going to go to our next caller. That's Sanjay, I believe. Are you there?
Yes, good evening.
Hi, welcome to City Visions.
I'm calling from Fremont. Yes, good evening. I had a comment on the... one of your hosts mentioned that, you know, he's worried about repeat drug offenders and how do you punish them. And this is where I really think drug offense and possession of drugs, not selling drugs, but possession of drugs, is really a disease, and we should not be treating it as a crime. And, you know, you're not going to be able to deter them by making it a felony. The second thing is I don't believe I want to give the district attorney power to decide whether it's a misdemeanor, to charge it as a misdemeanor or a felony, because, you know, you look at the records of how African Americans have been, you know, unfairly charged on certain crimes. You look at the records, there's a clear bias over there. In fact, in some cases, you know, we have police officers who actually plant a possession of a drug. Okay, so it's something that's very easy to fake. So really, on the drug usage, I feel very strongly that in North America, or especially in the USA, we've been treating people who are sick and treating them as felons. It's a catastrophe, and I'm really glad that we're finally fixing this with this proposition.
Thanks, Sanjay.
I just wanted to comment one thing on that. I've paid a lot of attention to studies both in San Francisco and other places relating to racial bias in policing. I don't know what the numbers are for San Mateo, but even in San Francisco, if you're African-American, you're four times as likely to be stopped for a traffic violation. For drug offenses, almost 60% of the individuals charged with drug offenses in San Francisco are African-American, even though the African-American population is less than 6%. And so there's no question that there's racial bias, particularly when it comes to drug offenses. You know, there's been studies, national studies, by the federal government showing that the majority of drug users are white, and that actually per capita, whites use drugs more than African Americans do. But across the board, you see African Americans are more likely to be prosecuted and charged for these offenses, and then more likely to do more severe prison sentences. So I think that this reform is one way to begin addressing these kinds of inequities in the criminal justice system.
Al Serrato, you know, San Mateo is one county out of, I think, 58, and
yes,
perhaps it does a lot better than others in mm-hmm. this area. But the numbers suggest that across the board, there's an issue here that the caller Sanjay is mentioning, referencing.
The issue being that we're not helping someone who has a disease? Is that...
That was his first point. The second point was that there's disparities, racial disparities in the numbers of people.
Well, I'll take that one first. I mean, as a prosecutor, my role is to review cases, make filing decisions. I don't set policy. I welcome the discussion. It's a discussion we're having across the nation. It's not my experience. I've charged many, many white individuals with all kinds of crimes, including possession crimes. And in fact, when I review a case for filing, I don't know what race they are. It's not because it's not listed. It is there on the report, but because we don't look at that. It's irrelevant to us. We're making decisions based on the provability of a case. So whether there's implicit bias that occurs with police departments, or whether it's a function of demographics or pattern recognition when officers are on the street, I mean, those are things that we need to talk about as a society. But I can assure you from my experience that race plays no role for us in making decisions about filing cases. And as to Sanjay's other point, I think he probably hasn't spent enough time talking to the collateral damage that occurs when you have people that are addicted to crime. Talk to the father of someone who is living on the street, who's destroying himself because he can't break his meth addiction, who's looking to the system to help him. It's not like having diabetes where you can, with health care, you know, go get treated or some other disease. It's a disease of the will. It's someone who whose will has now been turned against themselves and against those that are closest to them. They're going to hurt their family. They're going to steal from their family. They're going to hurt their community. For one thing, they're not working, probably, if they're addicted to drugs, and so they need to support their habit. If they're up for days on end because they're addicted to meth, they're probably going to be violent, and so we're going to see domestic violence oftentimes. We're going to see elder abuse, which is increasing in our communities. And so what you have someone who's spiraling out of control, and the role of government in that setting is to step in. And tough love, probably, is the closest analogy I can use, that you know, a parent raising a child who is willfully defiant to that parent, better think about tough love if they want that child to turn out right. Because while there's a time to give them praise, there's a time to hold them, hold them up short, stop them from what they're doing. And so in that setting, now this is in every case. I don't want to charge every person who possesses a hydrocodone tablet with a felony. But for people who are addicted to crime, there's a lot in their wake. And if we can step in and attach a consequence that fits that and get them on that road to rehabilitation, because we're offering that, the society has plenty of programs to help people make that transition when they're ready. They're not going to be ready unless they feel that the consequence to them is strong enough. And we're not going in that direction with Prop 47.
All right, but if you follow the same reasoning, I mean, you know, you should put, you know, people who overeat in jail and people who don't mow their lawns. I mean, you know, is jail time and convicting somebody of a crime, is that the best way to deal with drug addiction? And in many cases, I would argue it's not just a matter of will. In many cases, you know, people who abuse drugs are abusing drugs for the same people, same reasons that people smoke cigarettes. So, and to simply say that by charging them with a crime, we're going to change behavior, that hasn't been, you know, my experience. What I would like to see is that we treat drug use and abuse as a health emergency. I mean, just like we would any other disease.
So there's obviously a health component, and I'm not blind to that. But the problem with the overeater example is that if this overeater were, you know, beating his girlfriend because he's staying up for days eating, if he's stealing from the store constantly to feed his habit, then yes, we would be addressing that. But that's not what you see with overeating or with someone who's failing to mow a lawn. But it is what you see with highly addictive drugs. They're progressive and they're addictive. And we've known that for a long time. And I think the problem, in my view, is that we're trying to fix it overnight, and you can't. Human nature doesn't work like that. We're not going to solve this. What we're doing is taking a step in the wrong direction when it comes to those individuals. Not all individuals, but those that are most in need of our response. We no longer have the tools.
All right, we need to take a quick break.
Sure.
You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. And tonight we're talking about Proposition 47 with our guest, Jeff Adachi, public defender in San Francisco, Al Serrato, the assistant DA in San Mateo, and Melena Blake, a fellow with the Justice Advocacy Project at Stanford Law School. And we want to hear from you. We've had some great comments and calls so far. You can let us know what you think about Prop 47, whether you're for it, whether you're against it. Maybe you're someone who's been personally affected by it, good or bad. And in that case, we especially want to hear from you. But let us know what you think. The phone number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Melena Blake, one thing that we haven't talked much about is the background of where Prop 47 came from. And I know you and your group have put out a report about Prop 47, and a lot of it looks into the context. If you could tell us more about why did Prop 47 come about in the first place?
Yeah, so I briefly mentioned this earlier, but the core of Prop 47 was attempted to be changed through the legislature. So some of the things that, Mr. Serrato mentioned, there was a bill in 2012, I think it was SB 1105 by Senator Leno, which attempted to make possession of cocaine and heroin a straight misdemeanor. It didn't get out of the first house. The following year, there was a second bill also by Senator Leno, SB 649, which just would have made possession of heroin and cocaine a wobbler to allow for that discretion. That made it all the way to the governor, and it was vetoed by the governor largely from the request of some law enforcement groups. So basically, this was a change that the polls largely said that the voters of California supported. They didn't want the money being spent to incarcerate people for drug offenses in state prison, but it couldn't be done through the legislature. So the only alternative was the initiative process in California.
And as I understand it, part of the issue is also just that prisons here are overcrowded and have been for some time.
Yes, yeah, definitely. So California is actually under a federal court order to reduce its prison populations. So at its peak, our prisons were at 200% capacity, which means they were holding twice as many people as they were designed to. So the U.S. Supreme Court said, and this Supreme Court, which is not exactly a you know, super liberal court, said that that was unconstitutional, that it was cruel and unusual punishment to hold people in those type of position, those type of conditions. So they imposed a cap of 137.5% of design capacity, which is still over a third, holding people over a third of what was actually designed to hold. And, you know, we did make a number of strides to make that capacity. And Mr. Serrato mentioned public safety realignment in 2011, which made a big chunk of getting to that 137.5% cap, but didn't quite get there. And we started to see the prison populations inch back up. Since the passage of Prop 47, though, we've actually achieved that 137.5% population cap in the prisons and jails as well. The vast majority of people that were impacted by Prop 47 were held in county jails, over 9,000 people. And the result of that has been is more flexibility in counties to manage their jail population. But also we're seeing people actually serve their full felony sentence. So, for example, in Los Angeles County, felons were generally only serving about 20% of their sentence. They're now serving 100% because the county jail now has room to hold them because they're not being the beds aren't being taken up by drug addicts.
What about that point that even for critics of Prop 47, there's this idea that because of the overcrowding issue in California prisons, reducing that overcrowding will make room for the most violent offenders?
Well, I think we had room for violent offenders. And again, I'm not advocating putting all drug users into prison. My position is simply that we took a tool away that was essential in some cases. The problem with the initiative process is that voters aren't really studying it, and it hits a grandfather clock with a sledgehammer instead of, you know, some fine-tuned instrument that, you know, you would use to try to adjust something. And that's the way the process is supposed to work. You know, California has an interesting history of the initiative process. I studied it and see that why it was needed 100 years ago and why it still, you know, has its place. But crafting policy is not probably its best use, and I think this is an example of it. As I recall, the initiative was touted as the Safe Schools, Safe Streets and Schools initiative. So if a lot of voters are simply looking at that and haven't spent time in a DA's office, haven't spoken to victims of crime, they may not have a complete picture. And then we've made this massive change that now we're implementing.
I would take umbrage with you know, Al's criticism of the initiative process, because prosecutors and law enforcement and politicians have used the initiative process again and again and again to bring some of the most draconian laws. You know, all these crimes now that we're seeing, you know, our life in prison crimes for juveniles, you know, that all came from the initiative process.
Then Jeff and I agree that the initiative process can have its problems.
I hope you objected back then. But, I mean, you know, these, you know, the idea of, you know, the initiatives being passed, you know, to change outcomes in cases, that it was very much abused, I think, by politicians who wanted to look tough on crime, right? That was a position that you could take that would be elected Democrats and Republicans alike. And the result is that our patchwork of criminal justice laws, of our penal code, are all over the map. And are still very, very punitive. And so now we're seeing reforms like the three strikes reform, Prop 47. What we really need, I think, is an overhaul of our criminal justice system, sentencing reform, but we haven't seen that happen yet, to reflect, I think, what Californians want, that they want a system that punishes individuals who commit serious crimes and at the same time, you know, doesn't waste valuable resources and taxpayer dollars on locking up somebody who doesn't need to be locked up.
You get this idea of an overhaul of sentencing guidelines. How do you make that case politically? Because any pulling back of sentencing is going to potentially result in crimes being committed that might have not been committed otherwise. And so you have to tell the person who's the victim of that crime, who's legitimately upset is a light word for it, that the least bad option involves there being more crime, and in particular the one that happened to them.
We're not talking about decriminalizing, you know, crimes. It's like, for example, welfare fraud, right? That is a crime, you know, which is still treated as a felony. And what typically happens is that the person is placed on some kind of payment program over a period of time, but they still remain convicted of a felony. Now, they're expected to pay back the money and expected to work to pay back that money. That's, you know, one crime that I would like to see reform, so it's not treated as harshly, particularly if the person pays it back. But, you know, there are still many crimes which I think are treated in a manner which is inconsistent with, you know, what the criminal justice system seeks to do. And the amount of people that we have in custody, and as I mentioned earlier, the cost is taken away from other important needs that we have, such as education, right? When we're spending more money on corrections than we are on higher education, that's a problem.
All right. Well, let's get back to our callers. We've got Raymond in Oakland here. Raymond, are you there?
Yeah.
Welcome to City Visions. Do you have a question or a comment for our guests?
Yeah, comment to the prosecutor. I mean, I don't know where you've been, but there's a book called Dope Incorporated that proved by the, Internal Security Bureau or something, some political group, that lays out how the dope, whole dope war is doublespeak. I mean, from Nixon, Reagan, on down to Bush, all of them had their hands in the dope business. You know, they're selling dope, pushing dope. And what for? To make those guys at the bottom, the poor guys, null void. They can't vote, take their citizenship, because we're rapidly approaching a 50% population that's going to be non-white in the country. So they're doing everything they can do to make them not have any citizenship. You know, come on. And there's no reform for that. It's like slavery. When the British were tired of slavery and got to be industrial, they abolished it. Then they said, well, America, you're next. So America, same thing. America got to be industrial. It says, we'll abolish it. Reform is not the answer.
All right. Well, thank you, Raymond. And I think Milena had a comment.
Yeah, Raymond, I just want to clarify something, and I hope everyone that has a felony record can hear me. If you have a felony record in California, you can register to vote, and you should vote. I think that's a really common misperception, and I would love to change that as much as possible. Unless you are in prison or on parole, you can vote in the state of California regardless of your record. So, Raymond, if you have a record or you know people that do, please go out and register to vote and actually vote. It's critical because you're right. That's a voice that needs to be heard.
And I think what I would say in response, I haven't read the book that he's referencing, but I don't like the terminology war on drugs either. We don't wage war on crime that occurs repeatedly. We don't wage war on vandalism or on other types of crime. What we do is we set law that reflects policy. It's not that I'm anti-drug. I think drugs are good if they're used correctly, like under prescription. But what I am is pro-sober living, because I think it's better to live that way. And I think society generally reflected that. And that when people are sober and are contributing to society, society benefits. And so what we're trying to do is enforce that. And the whole terminology that somehow we could take on a war and defeat it was a mistake. We need to address those that are profiting by the misery they inflict on others. But we also need to address demand. We need to get people to see that trying to use drugs as a crutch for pain in life, for disappointment, is not as good as developing positive habits of sober living. So I don't like the terminology either, but probably for different reasons than our caller.
Well, maybe you should run for president, because I don't think anyone else has been successful in convincing, you know, the millions of Americans who are, you know, the largest consumers of drugs. This has always been true. Not to mention alcohol and pot, which, you know, is quickly becoming legal. So, I mean, you know, this is a social problem, not a criminal justice problem.
All right. To that point, let's go to our next call. This is Jimmy in Oakland. Jimmy, are you there?
Yes, I'm there.
Welcome to City Visions. Do you have a question or a comment?
I just had two thoughts in reference to what the point the DA was making in looking to the results of drug reuse in certain cases. So the DA was, from my understanding, saying that he needs this tool, the discretion to charge a felony in order to prevent domestic violence, in order to prevent elder abuse. But it seems like there's already, if those things are happening, there are tools he has. He can charge those separate crimes. And so to treat the underlying addiction rather than just using leverage of saying this risk of incarceration in prison for extended amount of time is the only way to treat it, that seems like a flaw. And it also carries, in my mind, other flaws that a lot of people don't see. For example, if someone's coming from poverty and they don't have the ability to post bail and they're in custody, whether they're innocent or guilty, and so they're awaiting trial, and during that period they're given an offer, which is get out of jail today, right? But you have to admit guilt, right? The idea of whether they're innocent or guilty is just a facade, because yes, they might be innocent, but they're in custody and they're facing a trial which might lead to a felony conviction. So for a lot of people who are facing criminal convictions, this leverage that the district attorney has can be used to basically eliminate whether they're the meaning of guilt or innocence. So one, it feels like the DA doesn't need this tool to charge domestic violence, to charge elder abuse, because those are separate crimes that are already codified.
All right.
And charged for. You don't need to cast a net for those crimes.
Jimmy, I want to thank you for your call. And, you know, he touched on a number of points.
Of course, the point I'm trying to make is that I don't want to see people victimized. I don't want to see that elderly person battered because we didn't deal with the addict earlier in his criminal career, or the spouse or girlfriend or whoever hurt because he spun out on meth for 3 or 4 days without sleeping. And I'm painting the picture that when we talk about drug use, there's a tendency to make it seem like it's a victimless crime. But if you work in the system, if you go out on ride-alongs with the police or you do outreach where you see what happens, that often, not always, but often, you're going to see a spiraling downward trend from people who are addicted to drugs. And if you don't have a means of addressing that, it's going to escalate in some, in my view, many cases, into something that we'd rather avoid.
The point that Melina made earlier is that part of where Prop 47 came from is just the overcrowding in California prisons. And actually, incarceration rates across the U.S., I believe the U.S. has, was it the second highest incarceration rate per capita?
I think we're number one.
Number one. All right. Not not where you want to be. Number one incarceration rate in the world. The other countries I saw on that list towards the top were Turkmenistan, the Seychelles. Not the company that you expect. And so to the point that drug addiction is an issue, and that the point that Al Serrato made, that these are people who may commit violent crimes when they're on the street. Right now, the approach that we have is resulting in the number one incarceration rate in the world. So what does work? It seems like the current approach has gotten us to where we are now, which I don't think anybody agrees is ideal. What would be a better way of handling that issue?
Well, you know, I wanted to validate something that Jimmy said, that a lot of people are in jail. In San Francisco, 85% of the people are in jail what they call a pretrial or pretrial detention because they can't afford bail. We could do a whole show on the need for bail reform, but it places pressure on people to plead guilty just to get out, and that's a reality of our justice system that people who can't afford bail, it doesn't matter. You could be Bernie Madoff. He was out on bond. You could be accused of murder. If you have the money and you could put up bond, you're out of jail. If you're poor and destitute and you can't afford $1,000 bail, you're going to be in jail and unless you plead guilty or and until your case is resolved. So that's a big issue, and that's another reason why we should look at decriminalizing crimes that keep people in jail for nonviolent crimes when they simply can't afford to post bail.
We do have a few minutes left. If you want to call in and ask a question or give us a comment, the phone number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You're listening to City Visions on KALW, and our guests are Jeff Adachi, the public defender in San Francisco, Al Serrato, assistant DA in San Mateo, and Milena Blake, fellow at the Stanford Law School. We've been talking earlier about the report that your group released, Milena. What were some of the findings of that report, that progress report in Prop 47?
Well, so one of the things that we haven't talked about tonight is actually the savings that come from Prop 47. So one of the things that we sort of have been dancing around is what's the best way to treat these kind of crimes? And I think that probably everyone here and everyone listening would prefer that we actually prevent these crimes from happening in the first place, not deal with them after it happens. And so what Prop 47 did is it actually took, it captured the savings from reduction in state prison populations. And we estimated it to be about $200 million since it passed and about $150 million annually. And invest that in things that we know prevent crime. So increased drug treatment programs, diversion programs, mental health treatment, which is a huge issue that we haven't touched on, programs for at-risk youth in K through 12 schools, and then 10% for crime victims. And I think that's one of the things that we also haven't touched on is this idea that crime victims are entirely separate from people who perpetrate crimes. We know that most high crime communities are also full of crime victims, and that those people come back to the community and they re-victimize their communities again. So if we can invest in things that actually prevent that crime from happening in the first place, we'll all be better off.
You mentioned some of the programs that will be funded with the money saved from Prop 47. What are some examples of those? What kind of drug treatment programs are in play here?
Yeah, I mean, the language of the initiative is fairly broad, so it just says drug treatment programs. The Board of State and Community Corrections is responsible for distributing those grants, and they can expand existing programs to increase capacity or start new ones. So Mr. Serrato mentioned Delancey Street is a fantastic program. We also talked about drug courts. We talked about potentially housing, sober living housing for people when they're in drug treatment programs. We talked about maybe potentially employment training. For people to make sure that they can go out and be productive members of society and not have to fall back on property crimes to survive.
All right. Well, for all the doom and gloom that we've been talking about this hour, there is some positive note to talk about where the money that will be saved from this bill, which is in fact now law, is going to be spent. So maybe some good will come of that. That is all the time we have for City Visions tonight. So I want to thank all three of my guests, Jeff Adachi, public defender in the City and County of San Francisco, Al Serrato, assistant DA of the County of San Mateo, and Milena Blake, fellow with the Justice Advocacy Project at Stanford Law School. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
And for a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, or to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer tonight was David LaTulipe, and tonight's show was produced by Susie Britton. Next week, you can join regular host Joseph Pache for a look at the health of our local salmon and crab fisheries. I'm Raja Shah. Thanks for listening.